Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Max Verstappen takes a dominant Grand Slam victory in Barcelona ahead of Lewis Hamilton and George Russell, taking the first steps of Mercedes' recovery. This is the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is Round 7, the Spanish Grand Prix. Max Verstappen was absolutely peerless in the Circuit de Barcelona, Catalunya, where both he and his efficient RB19 were in their element around the fast, sweeping bends. Pole, every lap led, fastest lap of the race, and a 24-second victory. There was no one who could stop him. Although Mercedes stopped at least one of the Red Bull Racing drivers, with Lewis Hamilton and George Russell powering to a surprisingly easy double podium finish ahead of Sergio Perez. Perez started 11th, but couldn't make the kind of aggressive progress that might have been expected of his car, leaving him 4th and 53 points off the title lead. So to talk us through a rather foreboding result for Max Verstappen at the Spanish Grand Prix, I'm joined by an old friend of the show. From The Athletic and also our sister podcast Pit Pass F1, it's Luke Smith. Luke, welcome back to the Strategy Report.
Thank you, Michael. Really good to be back. As you said, maybe foreboding result. I like that way of describing the race, actually. It was not the most exciting Grand Prix, but for once, we didn't just have a straightforward one-stop race. There were plenty of pit stops, a few different strategy options. So it's, a lot to get into, I'm sure.
It was a lot going on. I do wonder at what point we stopped saying foreboding. Well, I stopped saying foreboding anyway and just say, well, that's the way it is. So I feel like we're getting maybe close to that point. Let's give it a few more races at least. I want to talk about this track and the challenge of it and its place on the calendar. It's traditionally the first of what we kind of call the European leg. Canada's always been in there in the middle. Kind of ignore that for the purposes of the theme. Also wasn't the first because we were in Monaco first this year. But it is one of those tracks that kind of pegs a moment in time for Formula One, doesn't it? We've got that opening chapter of the season, if you like, over, and teams tend to bring upgrades, which we've been seeing. Kind of is a more meaningful race in the broader context of the campaign than just being the Spanish Grand Prix.
Yeah, definitely. I think, as you say, this was always traditionally the first European race of the season, really. And this year would have actually been the first time that Imola took that place over. And a lot of the teams were bringing their main upgrade packages to Imola. Obviously, that race never happened. Then, as with Mercedes, as with a couple of others, they brought some bits to Monaco, but Monaco's such an outlier, you can't really say whether they had the desired effects or not. So that really did make Spain the first sort of proper race of the year in terms of its traditional circuit. We've got the updates arriving. Max Verstappen, he's always said that he's not the massive fan of the street layouts, and that maybe works better for him when he comes to a more traditional track like Spain, which we saw in full flow right the way through the weekend. But it's, it definitely sort of has an interesting point on the schedule because it's not, there's not a lot of, and I wrote this yesterday actually for a newsletter, there's not really a lot about the Spanish Grand Prix apart from its kind of existence. Like, there's not really anything where you're like, ah, Spain has this element or this element. It kind of, it's just there. And it is an important like timestamp and marker, I think, in the season. And I think it could well be that we look back on this race as being maybe a turning point for Mercedes or where Verstappen started his march to the title. But it's an interesting moment in time, definitely.
That track characteristic that seemed to work for Red Bull, as you mentioned, is, I think what's kind of interesting here, Lewis Hamilton said after the race, and this has kind of been taken as generally true, although as you say, I guess had this been a different circuit that wasn't in Spain, we might just be saying the same thing about a different track, that if you go well in Spain, usually you've got a fundamentally good car. You may not be quick everywhere, as we know. I mean, in fact, and we'll talk about this later, Mercedes did pretty well here last year, and they weren't that good at many other tracks last year. But Red Bull, certainly we expect to be good at pretty much every track. They have been good at pretty much every track. What is it that we learned about the way the Red Bull car works at a track like Spain that has us so certain, really, that this car is going to be quick virtually at the rest of the season's races?
Well, this is a track with such a mix of high speed, medium speed corners, a couple of slower ones as well. And it does, it's, that's why it was always such a popular track for testing. That's why it was used relentlessly before the more recent shift towards trimming the number of test days and going to Bahrain before starting the season in the Middle East. And Hamilton's right. If you do well in Spain, then you're going to be pretty good everywhere. And I think with the Red Bull, yeah, we saw that, especially in Max Verstappen's hands, like to win the race by 24 seconds, probably managing quite a bit as well through that race. Like, he didn't really need to push at any point. The start was the only point he came under even the slightest bit of pressure. Then yeah, it does really, I think, sort of, it does bode well. Verstappen is someone that's always thrived off being able to chuck in the front end, make it very pointy and catch the rear. And a track like this is where he could really do that. Street tracks, you can't really do it in the same way. There's that extra element of risk of tapping a wall. But yeah, you come to a circuit like this, and I think we saw Verstappen in absolute full flow. The Red Bull is just such a step clear of everybody. We've talked a lot about the straight line speed advantage, but it's just everywhere. Like, that car just runs so, so well, so smoothly. And it's really hard to see anything changing that sweep of races to the end of the season. I think it will take a retirement or an incident or a safety car, I don't know, but something like that to stop Red Bull, because the car is just on another level right now.
Sometimes I do think, though it's bad for the spectacle, it's quite satisfying to say, no, the car's just faster. It's just faster everywhere. It's not because it does something particularly clever. It's not because it's great on the tyres or whatever. This is just a very fast car. And I think that is what we're getting with Red Bull. I do want to contrast, we'll talk about the Mercedes and Ferrari upgrades as we go, I think, because they were sort of talking points of this race, but I do want to contrast something you said there, the way that Max Verstappen can really handle this car at high speed, the way he prefers a pointier car, to what we saw from Sergio Perez this weekend, because I think even if we talk about Red Bull's pace having been foreboding all year, I think it was Max Verstappen that really stole a march this weekend. We didn't see any continuation of the potential challenge from Sergio Perez. Maybe it will still come, but it certainly wasn't there this weekend. Was lucky to get out of Q1, did not get out of Q2. He talked earlier in this year about this being a car that worked a little bit better for him than last year's car, that he could really sort of express his driving style in. Is this sort of the counterpoint to that, that at what we might call a general circuit, a general traditional circuit that kind of really tests the car, if he wasn't able to make the most of the machine at this track, is that really the concerning underlying point for Perez's challenge?
Yeah, it is. I think that it was always clear that if he wanted to sustain this title challenge, he needed to translate the form we've seen so clearly from him on the street circuits onto the more traditional layouts. It was quite obvious. Christian Horner said as much after, I believe it was in Baku or Miami, and said that, yeah, Checo needs to, it was after Baku, sorry. He said, Checo just needs to do this on a normal circuit now. And you've not really seen any signs that he can. Like, we've moved away, obviously Monaco, he blew a really good opportunity by crashing in Q1 and then ailing home in 16th. And then Miami, it's obviously a street circuit with an asterisk. Again, that sort of allowed Verstappen to play more to his own strengths. And then you come to a track like this, and yeah, Checo looked lost, really. He did. It was a very messy qualifying. The off in Q2, and then that meant the tyres were out the window for him to have a good final lap in that session. And then in the race, yeah, okay, he got back to fourth, but that Red Bull should be finishing second. Like, Verstappen did it in Jeddah. He did it in Miami, fighting through from lower down grid positions to get a good result. In Miami, of course, winning the race. And with Checo, yeah, if you want to sustain this title challenge, if you want to make it, like, really go the distance and take the fight to Verstappen, weekends like this just can't happen. Like, yeah, it's not going to go well if you just sort of have a very anonymous weekend. So, yeah, I think that it's not been a good weekend for Checo and his title bid. I think that we saw this weekend why Verstappen is such the overwhelming favourite. He's got the 53-point lead now as well. But yeah, you look at the runner tracks coming up and it's like, okay, Canada, it's a street-esque in places. Maybe Checo can come back a little bit there. But otherwise, like, on a normal day, where does he beat Verstappen? Like, Verstappen doesn't have off days. So it's, not looking too positive, his outlook, I would say.
Yeah, difficult fortnight. Maybe it could have even been a difficult 3 weeks if we had the full triple header. So maybe it's for the best that we just had two races for now. I want to look at qualifying now a little bit more broadly, because as opposed to, I think, what we ordinarily get in Spain, which is a lot of teams understanding how the cars work here, you kind of get a bit of a 2x2 qualifying order just because we pretty much at the limit of what the cars can do because they understand it so well. This was quite a jumbled result. In fact, they were kind of the key talking points of the race as well, seeing drivers come back from positions they probably shouldn't have been in. Perez was one of them. We also saw Charles Leclerc, admittedly for mechanical reasons, eliminated from the back. George Russell didn't make it into Q3. We saw quite a mixed top 10, including with Lando Norris in third, which I don't think really anyone could have possibly expected. The conditions were a bit weird, though, on Saturday, weren't they? And seemingly weird enough, actually, according to McLaren team principal Andrea Stella and other teams as well, that we actually saw very specific characteristics of cars come to the fore. Why was it so random on Saturday? I mean, notwithstanding the conditions, considering that Formula One tends not to have random results like that just when it's a little bit cold or just a little bit wet.
Yeah, it was very strange, wasn't it? It was, it did really just sort of throw everything out the window. The tyres have been so sort of strange, I think, over this weekend. Like, we've seen, teams really reporting sort of different swings in performance, and if you don't get it in the right window, then you're completely lost. We saw that with Russell, with Perez, as they had their poor qualifying results. And in qualifying as well, Alex Albon talked about this in the pen afterwards, and he said that there were like these little rivers of water running over the track, but for some reason the colour of the rivers, like, it wasn't enough rain to really stand out, so it kind of just like blended in with the tarmac. Therefore, he couldn't really tell, oh, okay, is that a normal patch? Is that just is that a rain patch I should avoid? So it was a very strange session, yeah. And I think it did mean that we had this jumbled up order because we had drivers trying different things, obviously, and going at different times. And if they get the tires a little bit outside that window, then it really did throw them off completely. And I think that's we saw again Verstappen, like, he only needed one lap for pole, and I think he went 1.5 seconds quicker than everyone on that first run or something silly. So that really showed where he was at. But yeah, it was a combination of Alonso had his damage, Perez not being there, Russell not being there, Leclerc not being there. And that meant that people like Lando Norris and even Carlos Sainz, like second on the grid, is probably beyond what that Ferrari should be achieving. But it's, it was a very jumbled up session, very strange.
Yeah, there are a lot of drivers as well in the top 10 who seem to have this impression that they should have been second, if only many other things had not happened.
Fernando Alonso, of course, well, should have been second. Yeah, of course.
I mean, really, he should have won the race. We all know that.
Oh, that's obviously, yeah.
Naturally, what he should have been able to do. Let's talk about Carlos Sainz and Ferrari here. As you said, qualified second. He seemed pretty buoyed that a first home podium could be on the cards. In some senses, it felt like he's a little bit like the forgotten home star, considering the Alonso hype. But nonetheless, he was the one who was flying the flag, not only for his home country, but also for Ferrari up in second place. Almost looked like he could grab the lead off the line with a pretty good start in the slipstream down to turn one. Didn't manage it. And then I think there was a general understanding probably wasn't going to happen after that. But what happened subsequent in his battle with what turned out to be Mercedes, I thought was really quite interesting. Ferrari, looking backwards, tried to preempt the undercut by stopping really early. That seemed to really unravel his race completely, though, although I suppose, look, it's debatable whether Ferrari had the pace to finish higher than it did at all.
Yeah, I know. I'm inclined to say that they didn't. I think they were firmly the third fastest team this weekend, trailing Mercedes, trailing Red Bull as well, obviously. And Sainz said after the race that it was just all about management. Like, again, this tyre weakness that the Ferrari has had for, well, really ever since the start of these regulations at the beginning of 2022. And Ferrari has always said, no, we're not weak on tyre management. It's just that if we want to try and match the pace of the Red Bull, then we have to push more, therefore the tyres degrade quicker, therefore it looks like our tyre management is really bad. And that was the line last year, but now this year it's pretty obvious, no, the car just isn't very good on its tyres. And Sainz said he couldn't push, like, there was nothing he can do. We heard in the early part of the race, he said, look, I've got pace in hand, but he had to hold back to make that strategy work. And that's why, yeah, he was an absolute sitting duck against Hamilton, against Russell. Perez easily got ahead of him as well. There was no real chance he stood of hanging on in there. And across all three compounds, the pace wasn't that good. And he came away afterwards. I think, honestly, he did the most you really could, like, to qualify second and finish fifth. That's probably the ceiling for what Ferrari could have achieved this weekend in Spain. Like, just that's where the car was at. But he made a joke about how easy it was to overtake, and he was like, well, for everyone passing me at least, because I couldn't put up a fight. And it was very, very true. So yeah, very, very strange weekend for Sainz. I think that he can probably be quite pleased with what he did, but for Ferrari, like, as we look further into the season, when we have these maybe more demanding tracks when it comes to tyres, then yeah, he's going to be, it's going to be a big struggle, I think, for Ferrari, because it's clearly such a big weakness still on this car and something they need to understand if they want to try and be a serious threat moving forward.
Yeah, I thought the illustrative point was that Sainz stopped 9 laps earlier than Lewis Hamilton did. So Hamilton effectively overcut him, let's say. It came out only 2.5 seconds or thereabouts behind Sainz, which is a remarkably small amount for that number of laps. Considering the fresh tyre advantage that's normally present at this circuit, well, is present at this circuit, not normally, it was there, but just not for Sainz. I thought interesting as well that during the race, I mean, Charles Leclerc was having a pretty ordinary race anyway, fighting up from the back. The fact he couldn't score points is sort of its own story there. But there was a little bit of debate on team radio at the end about whether or not he should be switched to the hard tyre again. He didn't enjoy it in the first stint. Team kind of overruled him. There's some team radio floating around whereby he says, I don't want to stop if we're getting hards. They say, okay, then stop, and then they give him hards anyway. I wonder whether or not that's sort of, if it just speaks to the fact that this team is, I hate using the word crisis, and I think that's overblown, but this team is really at a moment now where it's realizing it's got an upgraded car, it's got issue, well, it should have had development compared to last year as well, but is realizing it's actually boxed in a little bit here with the tools available.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that really has to be the reality check that Ferrari needs. It's always said that, oh, we're not going to like not think about the championship or anything like that, like it's too early to say these things, but that's the reality of where they're at. Like, ultimately, this is not a car that's capable of winning a championship. It's not a car that's currently capable of winning a race. It's very, very good in qualifying trim, and when you put Charles Leclerc in the car, we know what he can do in qualifying. We saw that so plainly in Baku. Then a good result is possible. But when you have races like this where, yeah, it's tough on the tyres and there's a lot of race management going on, then that kind of exposes more of the weaknesses, I think, for Ferrari. So I think that it shows where they're at. As you say, they are kind of boxed in right now. That, okay, they brought the upgrades to this car. Yes, it's a step forward. Jock Clear on Sunday, he was saying that he reckons the game was something between 2 and 3 tenths with the upgrades. And he said in Barcelona, that is actually a really, really good sign because, again, alluding to Hamilton's point, if it goes well in Barcelona, if it makes gains in Barcelona, that's a good signal for everywhere you go. But that's still nowhere near enough to get in the fight with Red Bull. But also, if the race is still, if the long stints still don't work, if it's still struggling so much, then it kind of doesn't really matter in the same way. So I think that's something they need to understand. They're confident that these upgrades will make the car less peaky. It was something that Sainz and Leclerc have talked about in the past, that it's just so inconsistent between compounds and it's very wind sensitive as well. But I think that, yeah, it just seems like Ferrari right now, they've not fixed any of the major issues. They're still in a similar kind of spot. They're happy with what they've done with these upgrades, but it's not going to be the kind of step forward they need it to be. So yeah, let's see. I just fear that as the season wears on, they're just going to keep sort of treading water in this kind of, yeah, sometimes second quickest, sometimes fourth quickest kind of area.
Yeah, and I mean, the drivers were still talking about unpredictability between the rear axles, which is obviously not a great sign for the car upgrade, but the team has said they're bringing new parts to pretty much every race for the rest of the year, so maybe that will be dialed out over the next couple of rounds. Now, just before we continue with the Spanish Grand Prix, I wanted to talk about another podcast from the Evergreen Podcast Network called Press Box Access. Join former sports writer Todd Jones as he interviews one of motorsport's most accomplished writers, Al Pierce. And he talks about everything from NASCAR and the death of the legendary Dale Earnhardt Sr. to his first ever experience of the Formula One paddock in Canada.
So NASCAR was basically primitive.
Right.
Compared to Formula One. And I did not realize how advanced Formula One was until I went to Montreal and left there thinking, my God, those people, they're either brilliant. And the other thing that impressed me about Montreal was the money that seemed to be there, the social scene, the yachts along the waterfront. I was told about all the jets that had flown in that weekend, all of which was just something I couldn't quite fathom until I looked at it and saw it up close. So Formula One was just, it just blew me away because I was not prepared to see things that sophisticated.
Right. Yeah, I think sometimes if folks could just walk into a garage, you know, they probably have in their mind what it's like, But if you took them in the pit row, it's like a different world.
You can listen to the full episode of Press Box Access featuring Al Pierce wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Now let's get back to the Spanish Grand Prix and our chat with Luke Smith from The Athletic. And we've talked about Ferrari, but Mercedes also had a spotlight on car upgrades this weekend. They introduced new parts in Monaco, but like we've already said, Monte Carlo is not really a great place to analyze new upgrades. So this was really going to be the test in Barcelona. Maybe somewhat inconclusive in qualifying, considering we got such a random afternoon in those conditions. But I think looking at this race, there's no question that there's a step forward that has been made. You know, we can talk about the strategy of Hamilton and Russell essentially overcutting Sainz and Russell overcutting a fair few more cars considering he started down in 12th. But by the end of the race, really by the middle, before we even made those last pit stops, it was clear that they were bound for podium position so long as Perez couldn't make up too much ground. The car was just that quick. But we do have this sort of counterpoint that actually last year the car was pretty quick as well. What's the vibe, I guess, we got from the way Mercedes was able to execute a pretty clean race or a pretty good result in terms of their mission to try and recover competitiveness?
I think it's a really good sign. I think that, as you said earlier, yes, Mercedes was good here last year as well. Therefore, you can't maybe read too much into it. You can't make any massive firm conclusions. Lewis Hamilton said after the race that, yep, it was way too early to take any firm conclusions about is Mercedes back or anything like that. But I think it feels a little bit different to last year. I think last year there was still that they cured that porpoising issue, at least they thought, and then they dug deeper into more problems. And I think this year there's always been that awareness that, yeah, they know what the problems they are. They know what the problems they have with this car, and they could tackle those from the very start of the season. So I think for them to be good here is a really, really good sign. They're not sort of, the issues aren't masked as they were last year by the porpoising, let's say. And Russell, he said that even after two laps, he was like, yep, I can finish on the podium today. There was that much confidence in the pace of the Mercedes. We know this is a car that's worked better over the race distances. It really does come alive on Sunday compared to the Saturdays. But for me, it was just the ease with which that Hamilton and Russell could take that double podium. They never really looked any threat at all. They were a clear step ahead of Sainz. Obviously, the Aston Martins didn't really come into the picture. Perez was too far behind to get any kind of late charge and to catch up. So I think that Mercedes can be really pleased with this weekend. I think that we could well look back on this weekend as being a big turning point for them with the development of this car and the push and path back toward the top. And I think that, it bodes well for their season moving forward. I think that they can be really, really pleased with what they've done. It is only the start and it's not where they want to be, because if they're not first, then they're not interested, so to speak. But they, I think they can be really, really pleased with the step forward that they showed over the Spain weekend.
There's a bit of argument, I guess, over how true the gap between Verstappen and Hamilton, or Verstappen and the Mercedes drivers, for the sake of argument, let's say, was. It ended up being about 24 seconds. It was clear that Max Verstappen was managing, set the fastest lap of the race quite late, and did it pretty easily and effortlessly in the way he tends to when he's told he's not allowed to set them. And then, on the other hand, Toto Wolff said that, well, there was a certain point in the race where Hamilton essentially engaged cruise mode himself and maybe was costing, I think he even said up to 3 seconds a lap, said maybe the truer gap would be 10 to 15 seconds. Does that tally, considering that Perez started on the grid ahead of Russell, had a worse start, admittedly, so by the end of the first lap wasn't ahead of Russell, but still could not catch him?
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? I don't think Verstappen was pushing either, though. That's the thing. Like, he didn't really need to towards the end. He wanted that fastest lap, but otherwise it was all about management. And the only times I think this season we've really seen the Red Bull stretch its legs is when it's been Verstappen and Perez 1 and 2 in either order, and they've had to push because they're fighting each other. But I get your point. I think that it's definitely a step forward from Mercedes, but I just really think I don't think that gap to Red Bull has shrunk dramatically. Like, it is surprising how much of a step they took, maybe over Ferrari, over Aston Martin, and both those teams had poor weekends. So whether that obviously factors into it as well, whether that's maybe flattered Mercedes a little bit. But I think that, yeah, realistically, that gap's been kind of similar all season, hasn't it? Verstappen's won most of these races by 20-odd seconds ahead of the Mercedes cars. So I think that Yeah, I get where Wolf is coming from, but I think it does cut both ways. I think that, yeah, for Perez, it was a case that he didn't really do enough in that opening stint. I think that's what really, really hurt him. And yeah, okay, Mercedes to be able to hang on to second and third does point to a step forward. But also, I think you've got to factor in that Perez didn't have the best of races and probably should have done better than fourth.
The argument that actually Aston Martin made everyone look a little bit better perhaps than they would have because they had a rare weekend, is an interesting one. We haven't really seen obviously, there's been one round in which they didn't score a podium, which was Azerbaijan, but that was sort of a bit of an odd race with very limited passing, and you got the sense that probably Alonso at least had the pace to finish on the podium there. This weekend never really seemed to get it together. I know we've already mentioned Fernando Alonso thinks he should have been on the front row, and our arguments for that, his car was damaged, but it is also a bit of an Alonso argument. Anyway, in the end, they finished behind Sainz, fairly far behind Sainz as well, so in this sort of middle ground, a little bit of a no man's land, I suppose. Is this the first challenge to how far or how well we'll consider Aston Martin's season in retrospect? They've had such a good run and earned that good run, we should say. It's not as if they've lucked into it. But now that we've seen upgraded cars from two of its biggest rivals, Mercedes and Ferrari, two teams that generally know what they're doing, is this sort of a sign that maybe there's going to be a little bit more to this story than the first six rounds have suggested? Or is this particular to the circumstances of this weekend?
I think time will tell on that one. I think that Aston will obviously want this to be a blip weekend, just like, yeah, not a good race, put it down to that. But I think that this does show that for them, the Mercedes and Ferrari threat is very, very real, that ultimately they've got to keep up in this development race because, yeah, a weekend like this, Mercedes was so far clear. It wasn't even close, really. So I think that is maybe a little bit of a wake-up call. I think Aston have, as you say, performed brilliantly at the start of the season, Alonso in particular. But even if Alonso had qualified second, like, really, probably sixth would have been his ceiling. I think he would have probably started ahead of Stroll and therefore beaten him because he wouldn't have just sat behind him and saying like, oh no, we want to protect the results. And it's like, okay. But I think I think it was really still the maximum Aston Martin could have done either way. So yeah, I think for them, it's maybe a sort of first setback weekend, really, because even Baku, it's like, okay, that was such a difficult race for overtaking, and Leclerc was just really on song that weekend, and that kind of reason why Alonso couldn't get in the fight there, and he still put in a very good race, I think, Alonso. So I think that, yeah, they need to regroup a little bit, and I think they'll just look back at this weekend and say, okay, where did things go so wrong? Why didn't it work so well with this track? It's a car that's been very solid across this opening round of races, but they'll want to be sure that as we get into these more traditional style circuits, that it's not a characteristic and not a sort of not where they're at moving forward, because yeah, it's worked so well on the street tracks, on the sort of like tighter layouts, but similar to Verstappen, how he's going to likely excel across this run of particularly the European swing through July, Aston Martin will want to make sure that this isn't a car that's just a sort of, street specialist or anything like that.
Yeah, really good call on that, in fact. I mean, we talk about this being the marker at which we can start to see a more general picture of performance, and that sort of brings its own questions to the Aston Martin performance. I think for the team's sake, they said the first stint, again, was the one, similar to other drivers, I guess, that undid the race. They had no new tyres to use in this race either, and they did finish in formation. Sixth Stroll, seventh Alonso, with Alonso doing well. I feel like it's becoming increasingly on brand for him, although I don't know exactly what's behind the brand, choosing not to pass Lance Stroll and doing the team game. Good for him. There's a final point I do want to talk about. This was a powerful undercut race because the new tyres on a car tended to be so effective. We saw two drivers use that to really quite good effect, Joe Guanyu and Yuki Tsunoda, who looked like they were on for points, or at least one of them would have been on for points. They came to blows around about 10 laps from the finish, and Tsunoda ended up being slapped with a 5-second penalty that dropped him out of the points. Joe secured those points, so I guess from that perspective, the strategy did work off for at least one of them. I want to talk about that incident in particular. I mean, on a weekend, the stewarding has been such a talking point, largely because of Gunther Steiner. This was, I think, an interesting example to look back on in the context of this year. We have these new guidelines about how you can overtake in the inside and the outside and that kind of thing. Was this a penalty for you? Or was this, there was quite contentious between the drivers, or was this just an example of fair late race racing that maybe should have been allowed to go?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was fair. I think it was hard, definitely. Like, Tsunoda didn't leave a lot of room for Joe, but Joe, for my liking, wasn't as far alongside as he needed to be. We know there's this kind of unwritten rule book in terms of overtaking etiquette and who has the right to a corner and things like that. And Joe was, he was going on the outside, and you know how it is when you're on the outside. Like, ultimately, if there's a wall there or something, then you know the risk you're going to be put at. Very different in Spain, obviously. But for me, I think Sonoda was... he wasn't going to let Joe pass at all. Like, that was very clear. It was a very bold defensive move. But I don't think it was... yeah, I don't think it was forcing another driver off the track or anything like that. Like, I think he left the room that Joe was entitled to. I don't think he'd earned the right to get a full car's width around that corner. So, yeah, it was harsh. And I feel for Yuki, because it was a really good race up to then. But you've also got to wonder, like, yeah, pushing that much to the limit that late on in the race when you're sitting ninth, there's going to be a point on offer even if you lose this position. Like, did he maybe just get a little bit too hot under the collar? But yeah, we want to see hard racing. We don't want to see drivers just like attempting an overtake, bailing out or anything like that. And similar with the defensive moves. So yeah, I think for my liking, it wasn't a penalty. It was tough. Like, it was a really bold, I think, defensive move from Sonoda, but it didn't quite go over the line that the stewards deemed that it did ultimately.
Yeah, I think that is a fair call. And it was really quite a disciplined race from both of them, but I feel like we're giving Sonoda maybe a little bit more attention as well, considering he needed to step forward this year and appears to be doing absolutely that. And we'll wait and see if that car can pull itself together by the end of the season. That was the Spanish Grand Prix. Pretty comprehensive win for Max Verstappen, less so for Red Bull Racing. We'll wait and see if Sergio Perez can pick up the pace and give us something to get excited about for the rest of the year. But Luke, it was a pleasure to have you on the show and talk about it with you. Before I let you go, though, if people want to hear more from you, next weekend, the Canadian Grand Prix, you're appearing on our sister podcast, Pit Pass F1. It's a daily wrap of all the events at the track. What should we be looking forward to at the Canadian Grand Prix, do you think? It's normally a pretty popular event, but also a little bit of a, as we've sort of mentioned, a bit of an outlier in terms of the run of European races we tend to have at this time of the year.
It is, yeah. I always enjoy Montreal. I think it's always quite a newsy Grand Prix as well, I always find. I think we have, last year, for example, was where the porpoising debate really kicked off and the FIA intervening and that famous team principal meeting that we've now seen on Netflix, obviously. And yeah, I think that, interesting that Lewis Hamilton said after the race that he had a meeting with Toto Wolff lined up for, well, I guess it would be yesterday now. So I do wonder if there'll be any updates on Lewis's Mercedes future and what's going on there. But overall, yeah, it's a race that is always fun. It always throws up maybe a little bit of a different result. It's one that easily punishes mistakes and things like that. So I think it'll be quite interesting how Red Bull can keep this run going. Like, Verstappen obviously is going to be the favourite. Perez, does he come a little bit more into the picture because of the street-esque elements of this circuit? But yeah, I think it should be a really fun weekend. I think it's always one that produces a lot of good storylines. Normally a really good race as well. Like, I can't think of the last Canadian Grand Prix where I was like, yeah, like there's always something going on somewhere. So I think, it should be a good weekend. Looking forward to getting back on the mic for that because, I was meant to do Imola, but obviously that got called off. So, it'll be nice to be back in the groove and bringing the updates from Montreal.
I look forward to hearing from them. You can subscribe to Pit Pass F1 wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Alongside the strategy report, you'll be well covered for the Canadian Grand Prix. Luke, so good to chat with you.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate it.
If Spain is the acid test for the season, then you don't need me to tell you that Max Verstappen looks set to crush the opposition. But there's still some intrigue around the battle behind him, with Mercedes, Ferrari and Aston Martin all taking big steps forward from weekend to weekend. Let's just hope it's enough to place them well for 2024, and maybe even later this season. Thanks very much to Luke Smith for joining me. You can subscribe to The Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a rating and a review to help spread the word. You can also find us on social media. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you in a couple of weeks for the Canadian Grand Prix.
Whoa. Ready to up your game and learn more about the thrilling world of sports betting? Introducing Double Down with Breslow, the ultimate podcast about the business of sports gambling. Join me, James Breslow, and a long list of expert guests as we dive into the art and science of the sports betting industry. Evolving regulations, technology enhancements, and the meteoric rise in the number of players makes this sector the fastest growing and most intriguing in the world. Unlock the business secrets from many of the industry's most recognizable C-suite executives, including famous odds makers and influencers. Every episode of Double Down with Breslow is packed with insider tips, deeply skilled analysis, and in-depth discussions. Don't miss out on the ultimate resource for mastering the business of sports betting. Listen to Double Down with Breslow on the Evergreen Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts. That's Double Down with Breslow, the business of sports betting podcast.